Rabbi Chai. I'd like to mention the following. Rabbi Shaffel Shlita is a source of inspiration and a source of Torah in our community. It's incredible schus to be able to somebody I know for decades already. It doesn't sound like it's the proper word to use, but it is the emissary word that we know for. Know each other for decades. He is not only a Rav, but he's a member of the Chesha Mishpachol and the Magid Shir in many, many different places in the city. And I'm not saying this because his father is here. I'm saying it because it's true. Exactly. That's exactly what I say. It's a cover gadol to be able to hear Jack and the Beanstalk, a Chesha Mishpah perspective. Rabbi Shaffel.
Okay. There's a, believe it or not, I don't know how much somebody thought about the topic before walking in today, but this particular story allows us to be able to analyze certain things in Chosha Mishpat, which after you'll see, by the time we're done, you'll see that there's an incredible amount over Shavuos. You see at the side, I said this originally, Shavuos. The course of Shavuos, I said at least 2.25 hours on Jack and the Beanstalk, and we didn't really get through the story yet. We're only about midway through the story, because it's an incredible amount of information which is contained there. So let me just give you the origin of the thoughts behind this shiur, and then at the end we'll sort of summarize as far as we get. One day I might have been at the Kol already, but my mother was on her way to work and she called me up and she said, "What's the story with Jack and the Beanstalk?" I said, "Mom, don't know what you're talking about. Could you explain?" She said, "I was reading Jack and the Beanstalk to my student, and she had all these questions about the story, all these difficulties. She is one who is in shul. We've been giving for a number of years different types of Chosha Mishpah type stories. So it's something which the seeds, as it were, are planted in her mind, and it disturbed her. Certain aspects of the story disturbed her from a Chosha Mishpah perspective." Said, "I don't really remember the story that well. It's been a number of years since I read it. Give me the book that you read, and I'll let you know." So she gave me a copy of it, and it is absolutely fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating how many different Chosha Mishpat ideas are contained within the story, and it becomes a wonderful springboard as opposed to discussing Hilchos Kinyanim, or Hilchos Ona, or Hilchos Mechachtos, all sorts of different ideas within Chosha Mishpat, to sort of follow the storyline and to analyze the story from that perspective makes it much easier to digest, much easier to go through, and it was a lot of fun. It was one of the most fun shiurim which I've given in a long time, and it's because of just the nature of it, the light nature of the story, but at the same time, the fascinating halachas which are there. So now that I know, I've said it at least once, that I have more than 2.25 hours worth of material to get about halfway through the story, we're going to try and pick and choose one particular dimension of the story to analyze in the time which we have today, and then the rest of it you'll have to work it out on your own. Okay, so what you have over here in the packet, there are photocopies over there, so actually two sides. One side is the story itself, the other side is the halacha part. So there are many different versions of the story, as it turns out, as I was searching for one which would have the information I was looking for, trying to tailor-make the story to the shiur. So the one which you have over here, we're not going to get past the first page of the story itself. In the basic storyline, all we really need to know for today's shiur is that you have this poor widow and her son. They have a cow, and they would get milk from the cow. Cow's no longer going to be producing milk. He says, "Don't worry, Mom, I'll sell the cow, I'll come home with a fortune, and everything will be good." He's on his way to sell the cow in the market, and he meets a butcher. The butcher says, "Oh, it's a good thing that I met you here today. Let's make an exchange. I got some magic beans for you. You want to trade the cow for the magic beans?" He's a child. He says, "Whoopee!" And he's all excited that he now has magic beans, goes running home, shows Mom, "Look what I got for the cow. I got magic beans." She has a fit, takes the beans, throws them out the window, sends them to bed without any supper. That's how dated the story is. It's no longer politically correct. And doesn't they should slap him? Some versions it said that she slapped him, but we edited that out. She sends him to bed, and then we know the rest of the story is the next day there's a huge beanstalk which is growing out of their lawn. The rest of the story, as I said, that will be part 2, part 3, and part 4, the sequels, to analyze what happens on the rest of the pages. What we have, for the most part, on the halacha side, as you flip it over, is we're actually going to skip the first page. The first thing, I'll just tell you briefly what the topics are discussed over there. In source number 1, you have source number 1 and source number 2 analyze the question of whether or not a katan is able to make a kinyan. She sends her son out to go ahead and sell the cow. Is a child allowed to make a kinyan? Halachically, midaraisa, somebody less than bar bas mitzvah, cannot make a kinyan. That kinyan is not recognized in halacha at all. Chazal, the Gemara in Gittin, came along and they said, you know what? We have, unfortunately, they're orphans sometimes, and they don't have somebody to take care of them. And if we don't allow them to make a kinyan, how are they going to support themselves? How are they going to get food? How are they going to get clothing? How are they going to have shelter? There's no way we could allow them to be without the means of making a kinyan. So Chazal allow, at a certain age, when they know the difference between, if it happens to be a nut in a rock, or magic beans and non-magic beans, but as soon as they know they can differentiate between what's a valuable object and what's a worthless object, so then they're sophisticated enough, they have a sufficient understanding that we could allow them to go ahead and make a kinyan. But, source number two says, and therefore, seemingly Jack should be able to sell the cow. But, source number two says, Bamed vay mamurim, that's always a qualifier. When is this true? That's the however. When is this true? That's true, assuming that the child doesn't have an apotropos. The child doesn't have a guardian who will be able to buy and sell on their behalf. But if the child has a legal guardian, so then there's no reason for us to invoke, to create this mechanism by which a minor can make a kinyan, and therefore he falls back into the Doraisa, the biblical law, which is a katan can't make a kinyan. Which means that when mom sends Jack to go sell the cow, it doesn't recognize an halacha.
She could have gotten it back.
What? She might have been able to get it back.
Well, no. why don't you say that she gave him the rights?
Oh, so now the question is, right now, one of the things, at this point we pause. Now, one of the most important things, anytime you're studying anything in Choshen Mishpat, it could be a Shiloh Lemaisa, it could be the study of Shulchan Aruch, it could be the study of the Gemaras, is the essential skill of Choshen Mishpat. And this is the challenge, and you could answer it by Cohen, 10 years plus into the process, and we are still fascinated by those and their power of analysis to be able to pinpoint the critical feature of any particular question. So as we go through these sources, we're going to go systematically, we're going to try to go systematically through the different thoughts and through the different steps, but at the same time, some of you may jump ahead and some of you advance, but we're going to try and go through it this systematically. So what we need to do is we need to always define very precisely, and precision is absolutely key to getting the halacha correct. We have to define exactly what's going on to know which halacha to be able to apply to that circumstance. So I set you up. I set you up purposely. The story really set you up. But I set you up as if we were discussing whether or not a katan, whether or not a minor could go ahead and make an acquisition on his own. But the truth is that this shaila is not, can a katan go on his own? It's a little bit deeper. What's your name? What?
Marnin.
So Marnin brought up an excellent point. Also brought up an excellent point. And that is that we're not dealing with a child who is taking money of his own and going to buy a cow or to sell his own cow. He was sent the shlichus. He was sent as an agent for somebody else. This raises a whole new question. Is there such a thing as shlichus for katan? Are you able to send the child to go ahead and make a transaction, to perform a transaction on your behalf or not? Source number three addresses that issue. We hold ein shlichus katan. There's no such thing as shlichus. There's no such thing as agency for a child. And therefore, in the second paragraph of source number three, so the Shulchan Aruch there addresses one of the fascinating Gemaras where you give your child some money, you give your child a 10. Send your child to the store, go get me a container of oil. The child goes to the store, gives the storekeeper the money. The storekeeper gives change to the child, gives the oil to the child. On the way home, inevitably, what happens? Loses the spills the oil, loses the money. Halacha says the storekeeper is responsible for that loss. Because you should have known that there's no way I would send a child to actually make the kinyan for me, because ain't shlichus katan. There's no such thing as agency for a child. So when you gave him the oil, and you gave him my change, you damaged my property, and you, the store owner, have to reimburse me for everything. Now, the difficulty with that is that we send children to the store all the time. Right? One of my early memories is, again, we get to Eretz Yisrael the first time and you're in the makola picking up flowers or something on your way somewhere for Shabbos, and you see a little, a little pitcher, a six-year-old, buying a bottle of wine, for their parents, that they realized right before Shabbos that we don't have any wine for Shabbos. And there, they were able to, at that time, they were still able to send a six-year-old to the store to buy alcoholic beverages, and they would go in there, and they would buy it. And nobody hesitated at all to say, do you have any ID? Can I see that you're an adult? Can I make sure that you're bar mitzvah? Do you wear tefillin? Where are your tefillin mark? None of that. We send children all the time to the store. So that's why you have source number four. Source number four is Aruch HaShulchan, where he says that nowadays, things have changed. There's an Imre Yosher about it as well. It says that nowadays that we allow children to go ahead and act as a shliach, and when they come to the store and say, I'm here representing mom, I'm here representing dad, they sent me with the money, we believe them in their statement, in that declaration, and we allow them when we recognize that type of transaction.
In these times, when you say a shliach is not available, what happens if a letter is given to the merchant saying, I authorize my son to...
Yeah, so
would that be outside of the shliach's concept, or is it within the shliach's?
Well, it would be within the shliach, because that's towards the end of the halach over there, the end of source number 3. He discusses that. If he was told specifically that the child is going to be performing a transaction on our part, and that's what changes between the time of Chazal and nowadays. Okay, so now. With all of that, as far as that part of the story being taken care of, now we have to deal with the main issue, which is going to be our discussion today, which is going to be, we have an exchange of a cow for magic beans. Now, cow for magic bean, or their alleged magic beans, he didn't test whether or not they were magic beans. So when he gets home, he gives them to mom, and she says, if anybody, any rational adult is going to say, what do you mean you exchange the cow for magic beans? There's no such thing as magic beans, and she throws them away. Now, at that point, we look at it and we say, what happened? He got ripped off. Right? He went ahead and took a valuable cow, could have been sold for meat, seemingly that's what it was being sold for, took a valuable cow, exchanged it for a bunch of allegedly magic beans, which, at that point in the story, on page 1, so they're not the magic beans, got ripped off. Getting ripped off in halacha is a very specific area of halacha, which is a siman reish chav zayin. It's the halachas of onah. Onah says, the Onah tells us, it could work from buyer to seller, seller to buyer, but it's the halacha of exploiting somebody in the context of a transaction. You don't know the cost of a used car, you don't know the cost of a used computer. I tell you, I got this computer new 9 months ago and it cost me $1,500 and I'll give it to you for $1,200. So if you don't know anything about the used computer market and you don't know that over the course of 9 months a computer goes from valuable to almost a valueless, so you'll say, wow, that's a bargain, $1,200 for a $1,500 computer, and it's only 9 months later. So you think you got a bargain. In reality, I ripped you off. I ripped you off in a major way because it should have only cost you $200, $300, whatever the market is going to be. So Onah is a very serious issue. So there's specific guidelines as far as what the halachas of Onah are going to be. And that's what you have in source number 5. We can read that together. So this is now up to the main part of our shir. So Shulchan Aruch says, this is on the second page of the Hebrew sources, Kama tiye Onah v'yachayv l'hashiv. So how much is considered to be exploiting a person to the point where there's actually going to be consequences to that aveira, consequences to that to the exploiting? Shtus b'shava. It has to be exactly 1/6. So we look at the market range for an object. Let's take our example of the used computer over here. So there's a market range how much this used computer, and you could look it up anywhere online, you could go ahead and you could figure out how much this is worth. So that range, it'll cost anywhere from $150 to $225, depending on the condition of the computer. If you charge, let's take it from the perspective of the seller, if you charge more than 1/6 above the upper range, 1/6 beyond the $225, that now is a violation of Onah, and you, the buyer, the one who is ripped off, so you have a right to now demand a refund. Okay, so how does this work? Hareshamachar sheish b'chamish. Let's say I sold a $6 item for $5. So that's the case where you, the customer, you have ripped me off. I was deserving of more money, and you ended up exploiting me in that way. Oshava sheva b'sheish. Or let's say I went ahead and I sold you a $7 item for $6. Oshava chamesh b'sheish, oshava sheish b'shava. Either way it's going to work. Harei ze onah. So when the exploitation is exactly 1/6, so the lach is, this is a violation of Onah, v'nikna ha-mekach. The transaction remains in force. We're not going to nullify, we're not going to reverse or cancel a transaction. The transaction remains valid. However, v'chayav ha-ma'ana l'shalem ha-onah. The one who did the exploiting, again, it could either be the seller or it could be the customer, but whoever did the exploiting has the obligation to return that money, u'lachzira kula l'misana. He has to return the entire amount, the extra, the 1/6 extra which he charged, all of that has to be returned. So seemingly, exchange a cow for the magic beans, cow is worth much more than the alleged magic means. He got exploited, and as a result of that, so if it were to be exactly 1/6, so that if that was the way we were able to lock it in, so then the transaction would remain, Jack would remain with the beans, the butcher would remain with the cow, and they have to, refund some of the money from the butcher to Jack. However, go on to source 6. Let's say you now cross the line. It's 1/6 plus a penny. 1/6 plus a nickel, whatever it is. But once you're beyond that 1/6 range of exploitation, you sold a $60 item for 49.9, so that's already beyond 1/6. The transaction is canceled. There is no transaction which remains in force. We don't say, keep the transaction in place and just refund the additional amount. Once you cross that line beyond the 6, so now this is a point of no return, the whole transaction loses any validity, any semblance of validity whatsoever. And seemingly in our case, assuming that a cow and 5 worthless beans, that even if the cow can't produce milk, the meat itself on the 4th of July is certainly going to be worth something for the barbecue Shabbat. So that in and of itself gives it more value than 5 meaningless beans. And as a result of that, Mama Jack, she should be able to go to the butcher, track down the butcher and say, listen, you ripped off my son, you went ahead and you gave him 5 worthless beans for an expensive cow, I want my stuff back. I want my cow back, you take back the beans, transaction as if it never took place, go back to go, don't collect $200, and the whole thing should reset again, and the story should start again. Hopefully this time she'll know, don't send Jack to go ahead and sell the cow. As much as confident as he sounds in his ability to do so, don't trust Jack. That's seemingly where we should go. Now, it happens to be in source number 7, also we're not going to analyze it in great detail, but over there, we talk of there's a statute of limitations on when a person was exploited, when he's going to be able to return the object. Whenever you buy something, and it's something which is important to know, you buy something, and you're concerned that maybe the person ripped you off, maybe you got exploited in a transaction, it's your due diligence demands that you go right away to an expert who's going to be able to assess the value of the object which you purchased and tell you whether or not you got a good deal. If you decide to delay, if you decide, you know what, I'll just leave it on the shelf for a couple of weeks, and when I get around to vacation time, so then I'll go ahead and I'll have it appraised, and I'll decide whether or not I get ripped off. As soon as you delay, you've now lost your opportunity to go ahead and return that object. Unless they have a 30-day return policy. Assuming that there's no return policy.
That's an overage
or sitting even in the shtus also. I'm not going to do the first line. So that's going to be Kadeshi Yara. That you have a certain amount of time. Now she seemingly, Mama Jack seemingly missed that opportunity when she took the beans. She could have had them evaluated seemingly to find out, were they worth, are they magic beans, are they actually worth what they were alleged to be, which is the value of the cow. When she took them and she threw them out the window rather than have them appraised by a bean appraiser, whoever that would be. She was doing her own appraisal. Right, that's what happens when you look up.
It seemed that the butcher lost out on
the story. You're ahead of us. I'm sorry. It could be. That has to do with certain versions of the story also. But
I evaluate something which is rather than market value. You know, so bean seemingly looks like you don't have market value. It seems meaningless or not worth anything, but if I know that these beans are going to grow up to, you know, these trees or whatever it is, so maybe they have the market value of a cow.
Excellent. So now, again, I've set you up. And that is, again, has to do with being able to pinpoint exact definition of what's going on. Our discussion of Ona, again, this is something which is an important distinction in definition to be aware of and, again, to process through. There's 2 different ways by which we could potentially cancel a transaction. One is in Simon Reish Chav Zayin, that's what we've been discussing on now. The other is Simon Reish Lamed Beis, has to do with Mekach Tos. Has to do with where you bought damaged property. What's the difference between canceling a transaction because of Ona and canceling a transaction because of Mekach Tos? So the definition, if you give it a little bit of thought, so it's something which is obvious. Onah, the case of Onah is, I told you I was selling you a used computer, and I sold you a used computer. There was nothing defective at all about the merchandise which was being sold. As far as that part of the transaction was concerned, everything was above board. I ripped you off and how much I charged you for it. But there was nothing wrong with the object which I sold you. Mekach Tos is, I told you I was selling you a car, and I didn't include the engine. But nobody defines a car without an engine as a car. When you go ahead and you want to purchase a car, part of that is going to be including an engine. Now, we could argue about functioning air conditioning, not functioning air conditioning, with a CD player, without a CD player. There are ways in which we could question what is considered to be part of the essential definition or not. But Mekach Tos is when I told you I'm selling you object X, and it's really defective. It's either not X, or there's something which is missing within the object itself. In our transaction over here, the transaction between Jack and the butcher was, I'm going to give you a cow, you're going to give me magic beans. Let's assume for a moment that we actually appraised the value of magic beans, and the value, the market price for magic beans was comparable to a cow. So if that were the case, so then it would be a valid transaction. Comparable thing, cow for magic beans, that would be fine. Over here, when she takes, look, when Mama Jack looks at the beans and she says, these are worthless, meaningless beans, so what is she essentially saying? She's not saying, oh no, because oh no would mean that she knew what she got. They were magic beans, just the magic beans aren't worth as much as the cow. But she wasn't saying that. She was saying, the exchange was a cow for magic beans. You didn't get magic beans. If you didn't get magic beans, that means it's mekach tos, not oh no, which is a different section of halacha. We now take ourselves out of Reish Chav Zayin, because Reish Chav Zayin is when you know the object that you wanted to buy, you bought that object, it was not defective at all, you just got ripped off as far as the price. Over here, the issue was, magic beans for a cow is a valid transaction. But over here, they weren't magic. So I got ripped off because you told me you were selling me magic beans, and they weren't. So now, we move ourselves, we fast forward ourselves through Chol Shemish, where we go from Reish Chav Zayin to Reish Lamed Beis. And that's what you have at the bottom over there, on source number 8. Hamocha l'chaveiro. Karko o Eved, o Behema, o Sharmatalsin. I go ahead and I sell you, it could be land, it could be a slave, it could be an animal, or it could be any movable object whatsoever. It could be our computer, it could be our watch, it could be our car, it doesn't make a difference. V'nimtza b'mekach mum shelo yada b'halokeach. And at some point, the purchaser discovers that it's defective. There's something wrong with the land, or there's something wrong with the animal, or whether the object is broken. Machziro afilacha kamashadim. At whatever point you discover the defect, you have the right to demand a refund or a return of that object, because this is not what I purchased. The transaction was, I wanted to get something which was not defective. I now discover that this object was defective. As a result of that, I have forever, seemingly, I have forever to go ahead and return that, because this is not a matter of price. This is a matter of, you didn't sell me what you were supposed to sell me. The classic case of this, the case where it comes up most often, where it illustrates how many years later you're still able to return an object, is buy a set of sarim for a bar mitzvah boy. Generally what happens when you buy a set of sarim for a bar mitzvah boy is, it goes right up on the shelf, and it sits there through the high school years. Hopefully maybe a couple of years through Beis Medrash. Then after a year or two in Beis Medrash, they come back and they say, you know what, I remember my bar mitzvah, I got all sorts of sfarim. Oh, I didn't know I got an Aruch HaShulchan, I didn't know I got a Sheet in Mekubetza, all these valuable sfarim which I use in yeshiva. Now, suddenly I see they're on the shelf there. So I'm learning Ksuvos, I take out my Sheet on Ksuvos, and I open it up, and every other page is blank. Nakachos. I now discovered, I didn't know that I had gotten ripped off. Now, here it's a little different because somebody bought it and gave it to you as a gift. But that's the essential case. Is I had no idea it was missing pages. You buy yourself a new shas, so you're going to begin a cycle of Daf Yomi. You're not going to discover that the Gemara in Bechoros is missing pages until 7 years into the cycle. There's just no way you're going to realize that until you reach that point. At that point that you realize it's defective, you have the right to return it. That's the halacha of mum b'mekach. The only statute of limitations which you have on mekach tos is if you become aware of the defect and you say, I'm not interested in returning it right now. So as soon as you become tzufriden with it, as soon as you're willing to accept it, you can't then go back later and say, okay, now that I've used the sefer, even though it's defective, now I want you to go ahead and refund it. It was good enough to use when you saw that it was defective. That means that you give up your rights to go ahead and return it. And you can't do so anymore. But Mum B'Mekach, over here, she says that the transaction was supposed to be cow for magic beans. He got ripped off because they were not magic beans. They were thinking that they're not magic beans. It's a Mekach Tos. At any point, they should be able to go back to the butcher and say, listen, you gave us a bunch of junk beans for the for our valuable cow. Mekach Tos, we want our money back. Right? Well, so yes. Excellent. Now the question is, again, I've set you up. What was the nature of the transaction? Where do we find this idea of mum b'mekach? I translate the words. Mum is a defect. B'mekach in the sale. Was there a sale over here?
It was a barter.
Is barter different than a sale? And the answer is?
Yes.
It must be yes. But fundamentally, there's a difference between that which is a barter and that which is a sale. And that's what you have in source number 9. Source number 9 tells us that if I tell you I'm selling you a used computer, and I tell you that you're getting a bargain because I'm only charging you $1,200, in reality the market price is $300, I ripped you off $900, so that is Ona. That's what we said. That's classic Ona. That's one of the only expressions of Ona that we would actually have nowadays in that context, is a person gets ripped off in that type of scenario. But it says, source 9, Hamachlif Kalim Bekalim. Let's say you and I are exchanging one utensil for another utensil. You have, an iPod, and I have what did BlackBerry have to put out there? They put out whatever their comparable tablet thing is. So we decide what playbook. So it turns out that both of us got new jobs. In my new job, I need an iPad. In your new job, you need a playbook. So it turns out that neither of what each of us has is not going to be worth anything to what we need now. So we say, you know what, let's exchange. You have what I want, I have what you want. Let's go ahead and make an exchange. Now, obehema b'behema, we trade one animal for another animal. Afilu machat b'shiryon. Even if we exchange a needle for a suit of armor, or we exchange a lamb for a horse, ain lo ona. There's no ona in such a case. No ona applies. Why? Shezeh rotze b'machat yosem asherium. Because, for whatever reason, my seam is ripped. I'm making a presentation, I'm applying to a job. I need to be able to sew up my hem right now. If I don't sew up this hem right now, I don't get the job. I could be unemployed for years and years to come. That needle is extremely valuable to me at this exact moment. I'm willing to give you my watch. I'll give you my expensive watch for that needle so I could go ahead and sew up my garment. I know perfectly well that on the market value, the watch is worth infinitely more than the needle. But sometimes, whether or not in desperation, how the validity of transactions in desperation is another topic in and of itself. But within the halachas of Ona, we recognize that when bartering in sales are not the same thing. Sale is market value for the object. If it's anything other than market value, you enter into Ona range less than a sixth, exactly a sixth beyond a sixth. But when you enter into barter, when the nature of the transaction is a barter, the things don't have to be of comparable value. Because each person has their own personal interest why they want that object. And I may have an interest. I may have something which drives me at this moment to want the cheaper object and to be willing to give up the more expensive object because of my need for that cheaper object. And therefore, in this case, we could say that maybe if this was not in the chira altogether, it was a type of barter. So again, maybe we could say that the halachas of Ona, or the halachas of Mekach Tos, maybe they don't apply to the same degree. Sometimes, in the event, right, so that's specified in Allah over there, that in the event that the Smah talks about that, the Shaf talks about that over there, that in the event that as we're bartering, we mention the value of the respective objects, so then that becomes indicative that we're really interested in a sale and we're using the objects as Shava Kesef. So I'm using this as a $15 recorder and you're using your watch as a $25 watch, and then we'll supplement the money, whatever. But as soon as we mention the money, so then you're right. Then it will become more like a sale rather than a barter. But here we're dealing with the circumstance where they didn't talk anything in the story. That's why it's a convenience story for us. They didn't mention anything about the money. It was just a straight up trade cow for magic beans. cow for magic beans, if that's the barter, so then it may very well be that it could be binding. Now, you still have the element of the mekachtos. It would be a valid barter, even if there's a discrepancy in price, as long as they were actually magic beans. If it was discovered that they're not magic beans, so then you're really back to the mekachtos. But we have another important, essential part of this story, which now another twist to the story itself. And that is, who's allowed to go ahead and barter when there's a discrepancy of price? The owner, right? So you have, I own a watch, you own the recorder, we decide right now you need a recorder because you're going to be giving shear next and you want to have a recording of it. I need a watch because I need to know what time it is. So you and I can decide, I'll trade you my watch for your recorder, whatever the exchange is going to be, because each of us knows what's going on. If you send a shliach out to go ahead and sell your cow, does that shliach have the authorization to go ahead and start bartering with your cow to get magic beans? It'll depend on the authority which you gave him. Right.
So, you told him to go sell it.
You told him to go sell it. Right. So Mama Jack says that, or he really volunteers if you're reading the story, but he volunteers and she's masking. She agrees that, yes, go ahead and sell the cow, get us some money because we desperately need the money. So he goes, acting seemingly as a shliach, following the Aruch HaShulchan, which says that nowadays, when you send a child to make a transaction, we'll recognize it in halacha. So here, Jack goes out to go ahead and make this sale of the cow on behalf of mom. Instead of selling it for cash, he decides to barter. Not only did he decide to barter, but seemingly, again, from her perspective, when he comes home with beans, which she doesn't recognize as magic beans, so what does she say? You got ripped off. You took my valuable cow, you exchanged it for a bunch of worthless beans, and now we've got nothing. So at that point, what should she be able to do? She should be able to cancel, because that's what you have in source number 10. Bamed v'ayim amurim, when do we say that, when do we recognize that there will be a concept of the ability to cancel, that there's an allowance for discrepancy in price? The only time we're going to allow a certain range of discrepancy that we're getting ripped off, let's say, less than a sixth, that's when you are selling your own object. But let's say the agent who is acting on your behalf made a mistake, or a legal guardian goes ahead and makes an error. He got ripped off $1. Right, it's $1 beyond market range. Ben the Tauflin and Ben the Karka, doesn't make a difference. Whether this was a sale of movable objects, whether this was a sale of land, choser. Why is that so? So that's what you have in the Sma, the next source over there. He says right in the middle of the line, famous concept, which now we get to see, in the context of his story, how it expressed itself halachically, l'tekunei shedartich v'lo lavusi. Anytime you send out an agent to act on your behalf, the primary responsibility of that agent is to do something which is going to be to your benefit. Let's live to kuni, to be masakin, to fix something, to rectify something. Agency, by definition, is the tikune. I sent you out to do something beneficial for me. Velo lavusim uvas, to be corrupt or to be crooked. I didn't send you out to act as my agent to go ahead and get me ripped off. And therefore, when Mama Jack sends out Jack and says, go ahead and get some money for the cow, and he goes ahead and he says, I'm going to exchange the cow for beans, even if in the context of an exchange we could say discrepancy of value is not going to make a difference, but that's only true if it was Mama Jack who was making the exchange. Mama Jack can decide, you know what, I'm interested in the magic beans more than I'm interested in the cow, and even though the magic beans are worth $5 and the cow is worth $1,000, I'm willing to go ahead and do so because right now I'm desperate and I need magic beans. But Jack, on his own authority, as her agent, he has no right whatsoever to do something which is going to be detrimental to her financial interests, and therefore seemingly, transaction is null and void. And seemingly at that point, we could send Mama Jack to find the butcher, track him down, the GPS that she has, OnStar on the cow, and she could go find exactly where the cow is, and she could say to the butcher, listen, my son was acting as my agent, you ripped him off because you gave him magic beans rather for the cow, discrepancy in price, l'tkuni shedarticha v'lo la'avusi, I want my cow back, here are your beans back, let's call it a day.
How we need to be concerned at all about whether or not she really owns the cow?
No, we're going to assume that. That will be the prequel to the to Jack and the Beanstalk, how she got the cow. He might have, you're right, he may have yarshined it from Papa Jack rather than how she got exactly. It would have to be for the ksu, but then we'll have to have a prequel to the story. Excellent.
How about this? So there's one thing that you can get the right value as a partner, or that he doesn't have the right to be muffled, or whatever the difference is in the bar. How about
the fact that she didn't tell him to go barter? She told him to get money for this, and he got some rent or something else from it. But she didn't send him to do that. So the Shliach didn't do the right thing in and of itself.
Indeed.
We could be mevatel the whole thing even at that point, because he was sent to do it to sell it for cash rather than to barter, right? But even if there was an allowance for bartering, Imtin Soma, there was an allowance for bartering, because in those times they may have bartered things, but still, not that it's going to cause her a loss. That's what
he would have gotten a new cow to produce milk. So in other words, the butcher wants a cow to chef, and she wants to get out of the milking business.
Right. Same
thing.
Could very well.
So it's an equal trade, it's a good trade. Seemingly on the surface, makes sense.
She may be able to, again, that would be something that based for Basin to analyze whether or not it was Tikkunei or Lavusa, what the consequences for her would be. But sometimes, he might have bought something, but then has, huge, tax consequences. She's not interested in those tax consequences. So even though it might have been equal in terms of value, so for whatever other reasons, she didn't want it. Okay. Now, what we have to, what an interesting side, which comes out of the story, is the question when Mama Jack takes the beans and she throws them out the window. So now we know that the way the story unfolds is they actually were magic beans. So she took something which she thought was valueless, she throws them out the window, we discover the next morning that they actually had some value. I don't know if you could sell them anymore, I don't know if it doesn't say in the story whether they produced their own beans, and then you could have a second generation of magic beans off of that beanstalk. But let's assume that was the case. So this raises an interesting question about the acquisition of something where you're unaware of its value. And what's going to be the halacha of that type of case? And I'll describe to you the case which is in the Ramah over here, in source number 12. And this is talking about something, these types of questions happen all of the time. You read about it in the newspaper, every so often now is the season of garage sales and stuff, so you have estate sales. So you read about these types of things that you went, apparently people are experts at this, being able to exploit this type of transaction, but you go to, picture. I don't want to use a picture. You buy, you bought what was, you thought was a, what?
In old
coin, before we get to that, we have to work towards that case. You bought what you thought was just an old coin. It said on it 1929, whatever it's going to be. It had some foreign language on it. So you figure that it's a novelty. It'd be a nice paperweight to put on the table. Some, Kenyan, whatever their currency is. So you bought it for 5 cents and you put it on your table. As it's on the table, the kids come in, they play with it, they throw it on the floor. It begins to chip away at some of the paint that turns out on there, and rather than being some meaningless Kenya rupee, so it turns out that this is actually a valuable coin from Tsar Nikolai, or whatever it's going to be, and it's worth hundreds of dollars. So now the question is, you bought this for 5 cents at a garage sale, thinking it was a 5 cent paperweight, you discover afterwards that there's great value which was covered beneath the surface, it was covered over, so do you have to go back to the seller now and say, do you realize that I paid you 5 cents for this thing thinking it was a coin, and it turns out it's worth $200. Questions like that happen, again, in the garage sales all the time. So the Ramah says that you are under no obligation whatsoever to return that money. Even though it's a $1,000 object which you paid only 5 cents for, and we talked about before, seemingly Onah says, if you pay 5 cents for a $1,000 object, that would definitely, no matter how bad your math is, that's beyond 1/6. So certainly you should be able to demand a refund of it. So we say that you don't have to refund anything. The reason is, because when that person bought the coin thinking it was a Kenyan rupee, and it was only worth 5 cents, even though it turns out it was worth $1,000, he never acquired that additional amount. He could never realize it was there. So if he never realized that it was there, he never acquired it, and as a result of that, Because it's just yours. It's not that you ripped him off. He didn't own that additional $999.95 worth of value. That is yours for the keeping. That's what it says. That's what it says in the Ramah. Now it comes along in source 13. You have the Pisrei Tshuva. Pisrei Tshuva quotes the Avodah Zarah Shuni. So he asks another application of this case, and he wants to know. Let's say that the object was you thought it was stainless steel. So you and I know nothing about precious metals whatsoever. So we look at, there was a serving fork at the same garage sale. So I look at it and say, what is it? You say it's a stainless steel serving fork. I say, okay, stainless steel serving fork. I'll give you 25 cents for it. I'll go easy on you. I'll give you 25 cents for the stainless steel serving fork. And I take it home, and I put it out, and then my wife looks and she says, this isn't stainless steel, this is real silver. So now, is that the same case? That's the question that Avodah Zarah Shuni, that's the question that the Pisrei Tshuva deals with. And that is, the first case is that I had an object, I thought it was one thing, but it was covered, it turns out beneath the surface, there was something else which was there. That's one level of a question, that's the question that the Ramah deals with. Level number two, the Avodah Zarah Shuni's case, is you and I saw the exact same thing. Nothing was covered at all. It just happened to be that you and I thought it was something else. We thought it was stainless steel. It turns out it's actually silver. But you and I knew nothing about the value. You and I thought it was a cube of zirconium. It turned out this is actually a diamond. So you and I are not experts in the field. We wouldn't know a cube of zirconium from a diamond if it hit us in the face. And therefore, we assume that it was just a cheap piece of nothing. It turns out it was something which was extremely valuable. Is that going to be the same case? When it turns out that it's actually a silver, sterling silver serving fork rather than stainless steel, do I then, again, have the right to go ahead and keep that? Or do I have to contact you and say, do you realize you sold me sterling silver rather than stainless, and neither of us realize I owe you some money, we'll be able to go ahead and reverse the transaction. So the Ramah says that in this case as well, the seller does not have a right to a refund. That also is going to be a similar type of case. That's level number two. So level number one was, we thought it was one object because it was covered. When we uncovered it, we saw there was another object. Number two is, nothing was covered. We thought it was one object. It turns out it's something else just because both of us were mistaken. Now, we had a Shaila where there's a level three, a third dimension to this same question. And this was, I'll tell you just very briefly, the fascinating case was, that has to do with a lot of different Shailas together also. But I was, a friend of mine was cleaning out his house, a wealthy person was cleaning out his house, and decided that, he's happy with, he likes the shurim that I give, he likes davening in shul, he decides he's going to give me a gift of a set of crystal drinking glasses. Okay, shkoch, what am I going to do with crystal drink glasses? Baruch Hashem, I have little children. I'm not putting them out anywhere where they could get, within 10 feet of them. So I go ahead and I put them into a cedar closet for a while just so that they should be safe. Now, five years later, I'm visiting somebody out of town. So I figure, how can I go to somebody's house out of town for Shabbos and not bring them a gift? What am I going to do? I'm not going to just bring them flowers. Can't take them on the plane. That would be get messy. So I say, you know what? I have those crystal glasses. I'm not going to be using them anyways at any point soon. I'll just re-gift it. And I'll just go ahead and I'll give it to that fellow because why not? So I go to that person's house. I give him a set of crystal glasses. He says, thank you very much. He puts it into his closet because he also has nothing to do with it because he has little children. Now, at some point, he's remodeling his house, so he's going through his closet, and he takes out this set of crystal glasses, saying, I vaguely remember receiving them at some point. I don't remember exactly what it was. Dear, do you remember where we got those? Yeah, Shaffel came and visited us about 5 years ago. He's here for Shabbos. He gave us a gift. Okay, this is where we got them from. He opens up the box and looks inside. The receipt says $400. $400 crystal glasses dated 10 years ago. So he goes online, says, the same Waterford crystal glasses in today's market, how much are they going to be worth? $700. Now, that person says, does he have to call me, and do I have to call the other person to say, do you realize that $400 to $700 worth of crystal glasses have been exchanged over here, and clearly nobody knew anything, at least number two and number three, neither of them knew anything about the value of the crystal glasses which they have. What makes this a third dimension to that question is, You knew it was crystal. I knew it was crystal. Neither of us is familiar with the value of crystal. So again, stage one is... step one is, I thought I was buying iron. It turns out that it was silver. So it was fooled. It was covered. The real value was covered. Step number two was, we looked at it. We thought it was stainless steel. It turns out it was sterling silver. So nothing was covered. We just didn't know what the object was. Here, we knew what the object was. We just had no idea its value. In a case where you have no idea its value, we knew it was crystal. Nobody thought that it was plain glass. Nobody thought that it was, diamonds. We knew that it was crystal. We're just so unfamiliar with that dimension of the world where people are drinking out of crystal glasses that we have no idea that you can spend $400 on six drinking glasses that you use, once in the Ovo. Is that going to be the same Shiloh? Is that going to be the same Shiloh or not? So the psak which we received, because this goes beyond the avodah sergashuni, is that in this case as well, you as the recipient, each person as they receive it, as long as they know what it is, they acquire it for its full value. So when I accepted the crystal glasses initially, even though I had no idea they were worth $400, I don't need to know their value. As long as I know their crystal glasses and I accepted them as a gift, I acquired their full value. And therefore, when the second person, and I go ahead and I gift it to somebody else, and it turns out at that point it's already worth $600, so that already is a matana betos. That's a mistaken transaction. Because if I knew that these were $600 glasses at the time that I passed them on, I never would have passed them on. And in this case, I acquired it because I knew exactly what the object was, I just didn't know its value. So as long as I know exactly what the object is, I just don't know its value, I acquire it for the full extent of its value, even though I'm completely ignorant of it. And in that case, we say that it's going to go back to fella number two. The first person was a gevir. He didn't mind giving away $400 crystal glasses to his chavrusa. And the number two, he now has the right to demand the return of those crystal glasses because his matana was betos, was mistaken. Number two, in this, right, because his matana was betos. In the first two cases, we said that number two, when he passed on to number three, he hadn't acquired the value which he didn't know was there. So I thought it was lead, and it turns out that it was silver, or I thought that we both thought that it was stainless steel, and it turns out that it's actual silver. So since I didn't realize what was there, there was something in my understanding of the picture. Incomplete of my understanding of the picture, that's why the transaction is not complete.
There's a chain that proves that person, the second person gives it to the third person. Is the original person who gave him a teller not to go to the third person to get it back?
He
gives it away.
The first person or the second person?
The second person gives it to the third person.
Right.
Where does the chain end with respect to the right of the person who gave him a teller to get back his...
Toast. As soon as they realize it's a toast, now it's
you can go to the fourth person. If it's passed down,
seemingly, yeah. Then you get into a whole thing. What happens if it's not there anymore, and who would owe the money? Right. But seemingly, once the object was no longer available for return, so then it becomes more complicated in terms of being able to recover the money. It could
very well be.
That's part of what, right, seemingly. That's another dimension. We didn't get to that part of the story. That's another part of the story, which we're not going to get to. But whether or not, right, the question will be, somebody sees her throw these beans, which let's say they have on them an M for magic beans. They're not M and M's, but M for magic beans. They see her throw it out the window. They know that they're magic beans. They know that butcher. The butcher has been spreading around magic beans throughout the town, so the passerby knows for sure that they're magic beans. She seemingly, let's assume that the transaction that Jack did, exchange of cow for beans, was valid. You see her throw them out the window. You know that they're actually magic. She doesn't realize that they're magic. So does she own them? Is that a toast that she throws out? And you have the right to go ahead and take them, or you don't have the right to take them, or she didn't acquire the additional value because she didn't really think that they were magic, and therefore the additional value, which is the magic shabot, the passerby has the right to go ahead and acquire for himself, and they become the owner of those magic beans. So that's really what we were just going through in 12 and 13 as far as that matter is concerned. No, in this case, she didn't realize what they were. This would be like the Avodah Sergashuni. She didn't realize, she looked at them, she didn't realize that they were magic beings, and therefore she didn't acquire...
She
She knew there were beans, not the magic.
Yeah, magic.
She didn't know that they were. The magic, which was contained in it, she didn't realize it was there. So she didn't acquire that, so the passerby should be able to go ahead and take the beanstalk, or take the beans or the beanstalk. Okay, now the story goes on, because if you read through the rest of the story, in one of the version that my mother had, which was really the part which triggered her question, was that when he climbs to the top of the beanstalk, whatever fairy is there, whatever person he meets initially when he gets to the top of the beanstalk, says that the butcher took your cow, sold your cow, and all of the wealth and riches which the giant has is a derivative of your cow. So in the story which he had, Jack then felt that he was justified in being able to steal from the giant, because all of that was, because he got ripped off because the beans for the cow, these were all the proceeds of the sale of the cow, so he felt he was justified. That's the question of avidinish dinu l'nafshei, whether or not you're allowed to take the law into your own hands in order to be able to recover your property. It goes on and on, you know, about gazela and about rodef and about Yerusha. There's all sorts of different things. Again, that's part two, part three, part four. The story keeps on going, but I want to end with one particular thought, which I think is the most important thing of all. There's an interesting halacha in Hilchos Tefillin. Hilchos Tefillin, we know that the prerequisite, mandatory halacha of Tefillin is you can't have a hesach hadas while you're wearing your Tefillin. You have to be focused on what's going on your davening, on the learning. If you're wearing Tefillin outside of davening and learning, it's brought down, you're supposed to constantly be touching them to remind yourself of the fact that you're still wearing your Tefillin. Mishavura says, the Fasa Mishavura, he says that if a person wears tefillin at work, it's not a hesach das. Wearing tefillin at work is not considered to be a hesach das from your tefillin. Now you can imagine, a person is in work, if they're lucky, they work 8 hours a day, but they may be working 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day, depending on your profession and busy season. You could be putting in 14-hour days during the summertime. That's a long time. You daven, vasikin, and you all work all the way until mincha. That entire duration of time, you are working with your tefillin on, and that's not hesach hadas. Now, seemingly, all of us would say, ein lecha hesach hadas gedolah mizu. That work is so distracting. For the most part, we're not thinking about our learning, we're not thinking about davening, we're not thinking about a kosher brachah, we're thinking about getting the job done. I have responsibilities at work, I have to make sure to get them done. How could it be that work is not a hesach hadas? That's the question. That's the difficulty of that mishnah brura. In Hilchos Birchas HaTorah, so in the halachas of making a bracha on learning, so we know also, it's very clear that you make it once in the morning, and it covers the rest of the day. Tosso says because you're always thinking about your learning, you're planning on returning to your learning, so somehow you always remain anchored or connected to your learning throughout the day, so that allows the bracha to be able to continue throughout the day. But again, the Mishnah Berurah asks about, what about when a person's in the bathroom? When a person is in the bathroom, you're not allowed to be thinking about Torah at that time, so why isn't the entrance into the bathroom, why doesn't that become a hefsek, that should become an interruption in your Birchas HaTorah, and when you come out, you should make Asher Yatzar, and you should have to make a new Birchas HaTorah. So the answer the Mishnah Berurah gives is, while you're in the bathroom, there are halachas that tell you what you're allowed to do, what you're supposed to do while you're in the bathroom, and as long as you're in the bathroom, you think about those halachas, they become the connection between before you went into the bathroom and after you went into the bathroom. What this teaches us as far as the Yesod is concerned, is that thinking about the halachas is a connector. It connects point A to point B. I put on my tefillin in the morning, and I daven, and I may learn wearing my tefillin. Then I go to work the entire rest of the day, and then at the end of the day, I'm still considered to be engaged in my tefillin. Why is that so? That's so because while you're at work, you're expected to be thinking about Choshen Mishpat. Am I allowed to do this? Am I allowed to take this object? Am I wasting time for my employer? Does my employer allow me to take an extended lunch break so I can pick up my cleaning? Am I allowed to check my private emails? Am I allowed to check the news? We get literally tens and tens of questions from people at work about what they're allowed and not allowed to do at work. If a person adopts this idea, we take a very simple children's story, which everybody's familiar with and you've chazed over many, many, many times. But you suddenly look at it with this new perspective of how does Choshen Mishpat see this story? How does Choshen Mishpat, how does Shulchan Aruch analyze this story? Suddenly the whole world takes on, the story takes on an entirely different dimension to it. That's the way we have to look at our work. When we go to work, work is not supposed to be hesach das, hesach hadas, because while you're at work, you always have to be considering, am I within the boundaries of Shulchan Aruch, or am I about to step beyond the boundaries of Choshen Mishpat? And when you spend your time at work, making sure, checking, Am I within the boundaries? Am I beyond the boundaries? That becomes, the whole thing is considered to be engaged in Torah study, and that's why work is not a Hesach Hadas. But if you don't think about Choshen Mishpah when you're at work, then you run the risk, if you're wearing your tefillin at work. But you run that risk of having a Hesach Hadas while wearing your tefillin. In Berachas Torah. Perhaps, yeah. But that's really the point of the story, besides the fun Shabbat and the excitement of a relaxed thing and an opportunity to be able to do so, to be able to think about the halacha, but it's really to be able to adapt and to be able to acquire for ourselves this perspective that everything could be looked at through the prism of halacha, certainly the prism of Choshen Mishpat, and hopefully over time and with the investment of on our own part, we'll acquire that that knowledge and we'll acquire that desire and we will hopefully remain within the bounds of Choshen Mishpat and not stepping outside of it.